Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. France, 1937. That's when Marie Claire first appeared. The U.S. edition was published by the Hearst Corporation in 1994, so this marks the magazine's 20th anniversary. It's currently read by more than 15 million people in 26 countries. Marie Claire is described as a fashion magazine with character, substance, and depth for women with a point of view, opinion, and a sense of humor that speaks to the sexy, stylish, confident woman who is never afraid to make intelligence part of her wardrobe. A woman with a point of view, character, confidence, creativity, substance, sophistication, business savvy, brainy, magna cum laude graduate from Harvard, are just some of the words that describe Anne Fullenweider, my guest today. She's the editor-in-chief of Marie Claire, a position she's held since September 2012. And it's a hell of a job. Anne oversees all the content for the magazine, the website, tablet editions, and brand extensions. And that includes Marie Claire at Work and the partnership with the TV hit Project Runway series on Lifetime. By the way, she was named Editor of the Year in 2013 by Media Industry Newsletter, which is some achievement since it came just a year after she took over the top spot. 2012 wasn't Anne's first stint at Marie Claire. Starting in 2009, she worked there as an executive editor for 2 years, during which time she was instrumental in guiding the editorial direction of the magazine, including special and digital editions. Her impressive resume also includes editor-in-chief of Brides, senior articles editor at Vanity Fair, senior editor at George Plimpton's literary magazine, The Paris Review. And she also served as Plimpton's research assistant while he worked on his book about Truman Capote. Anne, thanks for coming, but we've run out of time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's begin with the obvious. You have a hell of a resume.
Oh, thank you.
How did you get from there to here?
You know, I've just always looked for jobs that interest me. And I think having a natural curiosity about the world is one of the best things a woman can have. And to keep that fed and alive, you just have to keep looking for things that interest you.
Well, having something interest you and then getting it are two very different things. Singing on Broadway interests me, but
Singing on Broadway is something that doesn't interest me at all, I have to say.
But I have no talent for that.
Well, you know, I did, since my sophomore year in high school, I had a great English teacher, and he actually encouraged me to get involved in the high school newspaper. Mm-hmm. And from then on, it's really been go, go, go. Pursue the story, look for an interesting thing to write about, ask about, get involved with. And really from there on, I was on my high school literary magazine as well. I pursued that in college. And when I got to New York, I looked for as many interesting jobs and internships as I could pursue at the same time. I was lucky enough to get an internship at the Paris Review. And that summer, two out of three of the editors, and there were only three editors at the Paris Review, mm-hmm. quit. So I think it's a...
So there was something... in Yiddish, there's a word for it. It's called beshert. It was meant to happen. They were supposed to quit while you were still there.
Well, who was it that said opportunity is a combination of hard work and... I guess it's hard work and opportunity at the same time. You've got to always do your work mm-hmm. and look for the opportunity. And so being a good intern and doing the work and then having the people quit and raising your hand is what I've been sort of doing all along.
Would you kind of consider George Plimpton a mentor?
You know, mentor is a funny word to me because I think that what I've had is great bosses. And I've done a lot of hard work and kept my head down and then just popped up when opportunity arose. So I've always liked my bosses and kept them interested in what I was doing as well. So I've never formally said, hey, will you be my mentor? Mm-hmm. Because I think at the end of the day, if we're all really busy and that can sometimes feel like a burden. But I think that... just sort of keeping people abreast of what you're doing and raising your hand when something that interests you arises is really
key. How did you know what you were doing?
I don't think anyone really knows what they're doing, but if you
if you're bright, sharp, and you shut up?
No, don't shut up. Never shut up. But don't necessarily speak up unless you really, A, are interested in what you want to do and you want to take the risk and, you know, you don't mind failing. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of talk about networking going on right now. And I think that, you know, you can't network your way into a job unless you are also doing the hard work.
Well, there's got to be substance there.
Yeah. And I think mentorship and networking are valuable. But I think they get a lot. I get in trouble a lot of times for saying this, but I don't think that they're everything. I think you have to you know, put the hard work into these things.
Besides hard work, did you have a really good sense of yourself growing up?
Not always. I certainly think that my parents were supportive of what I was doing. But, you know, certainly they didn't say, like, hey, you know what, you can do whatever you want to do in this world. They just were aware of what I was doing. They believed in me. Mm-hmm. And then also I think some of it just comes from within. You just kind of know. I mean, I've been scared to death of some of the things that I've done. But
we'd never know. You hit it well.
There is some of it is faking it till you make it, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when you really want something, you have the bravura just comes to you when you need it.
And when you were at the Paris Review and those editors quit, did you sort of feel at that point that maybe you died and went to heaven?
I just thought, let's see what happens here. I'm going to show up for work tomorrow. There was a snowstorm one day, and I was the only person who came to work. I didn't know that you didn't have to come to work if there was a big, giant snowstorm. Some of it's naivete, and you just sort of, you know, sometimes when you're young and you don't know what you don't know, mm-hmm. and you just keep showing up, and you say, you know, when I was working with George Clinton, and I had not yet started working for him, on the book, there were just all these crates of interviews under his pool table of all places. And I kind of just pulled them out and said, hey, what are these? And started reading them and say, hey, this is really interesting. He was overdue on the book. And I just started saying, hey, this is really interesting. What's this? Who's this? What's going on? His wife also did say, hey, he's 7 years overdue on that book. You might want to help him out here. But it's, you know, I think like everything, it's a combination of luck, hard work, opportunity, you know, matching of interests. And I do think naivete sometimes can help.
Now, take us on your work journey. So after the Paris Review, what happened to you and the book?
Okay, so I was at the Paris Review. We did end up finishing the Truman Capote book, which was, you know, just a great window on New York. And so it was—
Where are you from?
I was born in New York City.
So you're local.
Well, I was local for a year. And then it was the 70s. My parents moved out of the city. They moved to Boston, outside of Boston. Mm-hmm. I grew up there. I came back to New York after college. So I've now been here for forever. But so the book finally came out, and I was in charge of getting the galleys out to everyone. And I did everything on that book, from finishing it up, finishing the research, finding Truman Capote's first grade teacher who was still living on the Upper West Side, doing some of the photo research, clearing the legal. You know, again, what you don't know, what you don't know. I was not qualified to do this stuff, but no one else was writing the letters. Anyway, the book, the galleys came in, and I sent them off to a number of people, including one of the editors who had left the Paris Review and was writing book reviews for Vanity Fair magazine. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, dear Lisa, here's the book. Hope you can get it into Vanity Fair. And by the way, now that it's over, I need a job.
Have a nice day.
Thanks. And lo and behold, she said, hey, you know, one of my editor at Vanity Fair is looking for an assistant.
You know, this is getting a little obnoxious, you know, that this is all so coincidental.
Well, you know, I went on a terrible job interview that same week. I mean, I wrote that to several people. I said, hey, you know, could you please get this book into this magazine? One of the interviews I went on, I had a horrible fever. I went in. I had half an hour of conversation, at which point the editor looked at me and said, I think you seem very, very nervous. And that was the end of the conversation. You know, I also had a conversation with someone at the New Yorker magazine, which was at that point my dream job. They said, we have an opening here in I think at that point it was called the word processing room. And I said, very haughtily, you know, I was 24 years old, I believe. And I said, is this a secretarial job? I am not interested in a secretarial job, which was the stupidest thing to say.
Apparently not.
No, I think that was the entry-level job at the New Yorker. I think there are plenty of people who took that call and are now editing and writing at that phenomenal magazine. So you just never know. I think that was an example of a terrible move. Mm-hmm. So, you know, win some and lose some. I think every job experience, every bad interview, every good interview is all part of your story, and you learn something. If you don't learn from those experiences, that's the only downfall.
But you taught yourself, for all intents and purposes, didn't you? That's what I guess I meant about a mentor. You culled for you.
Yes. You learn something from everyone that you work with. I mean, certainly, I had great bosses. I worked for George Plimpton. I worked for Graydon Carter for 10 years at Vanity Fair. So by the way, that was the successful letter that said, hey, here's the book and you get it into Vanity Fair. And by the way, I need a job. So I ended up getting an assistant job at Vanity Fair, and I stayed there for 10 years. And I worked with phenomenal people and worked my way up to being a senior editor and working with phenomenal writers and great editors and a whole slew of characters. And again, sort of just by doing the work that came my way, raising my hand for opportunities as they came along. This does sound quite obnoxious.
I'm still here. Was there difficulty in terms of moving up the ranks? Was it harder then or is it harder now?
I think it has changed in many ways. There are so many new places to have your voice heard in terms of the internet, your own Twitter following, your own blog posts, your own you can have a very, very successful career and never get a job or a story printed in a magazine at all. And then find yourself a sought-after writer and get a column in a magazine. So I think in some ways it's easier now.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's flipped because we used to get people who were in their young, in their 20s, come in and want to write for a magazine so badly and not have any clips. Now we get people come in, they have loads and loads of clips from all sorts of online magazines and from all sorts of...
But, you know, everybody thinks they're a writer. No, you're not. There's a presumptuousness that you have a blog. BFD, right?
Well, you know, I think that was the conversation at the beginning of this phenomenon. And since I 20 years ago when I got to New York, I was still, I didn't have an email account. I was still working on a typewriter. So that's exploded exponentially since I got here, right? The entire phenomenon has exploded and then actually condensed as I got here because, yes, you can have a blog, but now we can measure your success, right?
That's true.
We know how many followers you have. We know your metrics.
Only your mother's reading your blog.
Exactly. So, and success is actually, to the great detriment of some journalism, you would say it's too bad it can be measured because there's some great writers out there who don't have the outlets that they once had because there's no longer a space for as many 10,000 word articles as there once was. So,
well, that's also a whole other issue about where are magazines going, which we'll get to in a minute. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Anne Fullenweider, editor-in-chief of Marie Claire magazine. When your 10 years were up, for lack of a better word, at Vanity Fair, you knew it was time to go?
So my 10 years at Vanity Fair, there were a couple of times that I actually left Vanity Fair at one point and came back, which was...
do that a lot.
Yes, it's becoming a trope. So I actually left Vanity Fair to go out to out west and pursue the internet and find myself on the West Coast. I had a fabulous time, drove across the country, had a boyfriend, lived on a boat, had a motorcycle fling. It was fabulous. And 7 months later, I got a call to come back to Vanity Fair, which was phenomenal. And I don't think that I would have gotten that opportunity had I not left. So that's a little bit of it is something I do sometimes. And it's can be a great career move. It's not always an intentional one on my part, but it does happen. So in 2009, the world collapsed.
Right.
The economy collapsed. Mm-hmm. The internet exploded. A lot of things happened. I was at Condé Nast at Vanity Fair, and I got a call to come. I'd gotten these calls over the years, but someone had called me to come and interview for the executive editor job at Marie Claire. And I had a great interview. I met with Joanna Coles, who's now the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan. And we had a phenomenal interview. I came to the Hearst Tower, which is a beautiful building on 57th Street and 8th Avenue, where I now work. And we just had a phenomenal conversation. And the timing was right in terms of when to leave Vanity Fair. Some people never, ever leave Vanity Fair. It's a great place to work. There are phenomenal writers and a great, great place to grow up, which is really what I did there.
Did you like Graydon Carter?
I love Graydon Carter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He really was a phenomenal person to work for and really built a...
What an institution.
What an institution and sort of a universe. And so many talented people walking the halls at Vanity Fair. And many, many people never leave there and maybe never will. But
And that's okay.
Yeah. 2009 was a moment when many things were happening in the magazine world. No one had as many pages to edit their 10,000-word stories. So I just felt it was a great time to take this great opportunity to graduate from the senior editor level, which some people never do. So I took a leap of faith, and 2 years later, so I was at executive editor at Marie Claire for 2 years, and it was a phenomenal, really fun, totally different world from Vanity Fair. I walked into my first day of Marie Claire, and it was such a different world from Vanity Fair in that it was almost all women.
Yeah.
People were running around with clothing racks everywhere. Vanity Fair is not a fashion magazine per se. So,
right.
There was just this great collaborative democratic atmosphere of sort of, it was much trimmer staff, the budgets were different, and I think there was someone coming with like a towel around her head because she was going to a fashion shoot in the closet, and there was just sort of chaos, and I loved it.
Were you always stylish and fashionable? Did you feel that you belong there? Like, for example, I could be a great editor, but Marie Claire would never hire me.
Well, let's talk after this.
That's very kind of you. But you know what I mean. That would be like my saying, I'd really like to work at Popular Mechanics.
They have a new editor-in-chief, too. We can talk about that, too. So the thing about Marie Claire, which I love, is that Marie Claire is great. We have lots of fashion. We love fashion. We have a lot of fun with fashion. We're not a snobby magazine. We go to the shows. We come back. We spread out all the wares. We talk about it. We tweet what we're wearing. We are not the kind of fashion magazine that comes back and says, we went to the shows and you did not. And here's a peek into the world that you'll never live in.
So Vogue-ish?
Vogue is a fantastic magazine. And I think there's a real place in the fashion world for aspirational magazines and sort of an elitist or more sort of... a different take on the fashion world. It's sort of like keeping it at arm's length. And Marie Claire is really, really showing you how to wear this stuff and what we like. And I just this morning was calling Marie Claire a kind of a band or a tribe because we really, we have a real spirit. And we love our fashion, we love our beauty, but we also love our rock and roll and our, we have a 20th anniversary issue coming up in September where we're asking people how they're changing the world. And we have a real, an esprit is really what I would call it. And so when we go to fashion shows, we all go together and there's a real sort of...
In spite of all these women, you all like each other.
We really do.
You have a sisterhood?
Yes, that's a great word. And we really, I'm not making it up. I mean, ask anyone on the floor. We just kind of, we have a lot of fun. There's laughter emanating from the halls. And
so people like to go to work.
I love to go to work. Yeah. And I think there's a real art to keeping that atmosphere alive and making it a collaborative environment.
So let's just go back to you. No, what I mean in terms of your career was so you go to Marie Claire and you stay there for 2 years and then you're wooed away.
Right. My husband calls this like there are only so many head coach jobs, right? There are about, I don't know how many head coach jobs there are in the NFL, but I think there are only about 12 magazines that I would really want to be editor-in-chief of. And to get to that point, you just have to hang in there for a while. So Condé Nast called me and said, do you want to be editor-in-chief of a magazine? And I said, yes, I do. And they said, well, come on over. And I chatted with them, and they offered me the chance to completely remake a magazine that they were, for the first time, combining print and digital. And that opportunity was really exciting to me, too, because that's very important right now to get to learn the entire digital world, which I really hadn't done yet. And it was Brides Magazine. So we hired a whole new staff. We revamped the magazine. I sort of introduced the print and digital staffs to each other for the first time. And I had a phenomenal time doing that. I think I'm saying the word phenomenal about 100 times. But it's been a great ride. And so I was kind of almost through my first year when Marie Claire called me back and said, or Hearst called me back and said, what would you say if one of your favorite magazines needed an editor-in-chief?
Wow.
It was really a crazy day.
So your answer to that was yes.
My answer to that was, are you kidding me? I just got here.
This is awkward.
This is a little awkward, but it's also the opportunity of a lifetime. And, you know, timing in life is never perfect. But this is a job I cannot, that's not, you know, these things don't come up that often. And
well, here's a story with a magazine like yours. When you look at the masthead, clearly it takes a village.
Yes.
You're the mayor. What is that like? You're responsible for everything, correct?
Yes.
And when it works, it's great, you know. And when it doesn't work, it's at your feet too, right?
Yeah.
What is that like?
You really have to be very, you have to learn how to hire really good people. And you have to learn how to tell them what you want, trust them to do it, and find about, I'd say, 5 people that you can rely on. I mean, at least 3, but it would be better for 5. And we have many different parts of the magazine. We have, you know, fashion.
Right.
We have the words, which are really important to me and is also very important to Marie Claire. I mean, one of the things that sets us apart in our very competitive, crowded field is our commitment to journalism and to women's issues and to telling good stories.
Your creative director, Nina Garcia, she's kind of off to the side because she's running her part of the corporation, as it were,
in a sense, right? She is in charge of all of the fashion, and she's a very strong collaborator. She and I meet I'd say almost every day, mm-hmm. unless she's filming Project Runway, in which case she is a big emailer, very digital lady, that Nina Garcia. And so she's in charge of fashion. She goes to all of the fashion shows, and she runs her fashion team, which is about 5 or 6 people. Very, very tight ship. And so we also have a beauty director who is the exact same thing for the beauty mm-hmm. world. We have a features director who's in charge of all of the words. I have a business partner, my publisher, Nancy Berger Cardone, who's in charge of all of the advertising, sales, and marketing of the magazine. And I also have the art director who's in charge of the way the magazine looks, and a photo director.
If you're just joining us today, my guest is Anne Fullenweider, editor-in-chief of Marie Claire magazine. What did you do differently when you came on board the second time? Were there specifics that they wanted done? Were they unhappy with
no,
the way the magazine
was
going?
No, they were not happy with the magazine. No, they were promoting the current editor-in-chief moving her job to a new magazine, mm-hmm. and the magazine was already very strong. Mm-hmm. What I did when I got there was really shift the way the magazine looked in terms of I wanted it to have a stronger visual presence, and we hired a new art department, really, I mean, step by step, and it was a very gradual evolution, but today I think it looks very different than it did when I got there. I also hired a new executive editor who's my sort of number two, mm-hmm. and she's phenomenal. We've worked together forever. She's actually a former colleague from Vanity Fair, and so we set about getting new writers and just sort of refreshing the staff a bit, just because that's what you do when you get to a new place.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really not even been 2 years, and we've kind of refreshed the entire thing.
Is this a 24/7 job?
Yes.
And that's okay with you?
It's okay with me because I love it and because I have a really strong, creative, fresh team who I love interacting with on a daily basis. And, you know, there are certainly no emails going back and forth at midnight. Mm-hmm. So it's like a 16-hour-a-day job.
It's 16 hours. But you're a wife and a mother, and
yeah.
You probably like to go to the theater, you know, and you probably like to take vacations. I hate this. How do you do it? But how do you do it? And well, look as good as you look, you know?
You're too funny. I think
I'm not too funny.
It's great that I have a fashion closet and a beauty closet at work. I will say that. But here's the thing. I'm not making it up. Really love my job. I love what I do. What I do touches all areas of my life. I have a 7-year-old daughter. I talk to her about what's going on in the world mm-hmm. and how, you know, the world she'll grow up in, and, you know, quote unquote women's issues are something I've always cared about. We put them in the magazine. You know, I read something or something happens in the news cycle, and it's just an automatic thought. How are we going to put this in the magazine?
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of things that are close to my heart about women's education, how, you know, violence against women, equal pay, healthcare, how to get women more connected to the political process. Because even though it seems like we're very connected to the political process, we actually, a lot of us are struggling with how we actually, you know, make a real difference.
Sure.
These are things that, you know, as it's really just close to my heart, and I think about them all the time anyway. Even if I were doing something completely different, if I were collecting garbage, that's mm-hmm. what I would be thinking mm-hmm. about. So STEM, you know, math and science. My daughter comes home and says she doesn't like math. I'm thinking, okay, what did I learn at that makers conference about, you know, astronauts? Maybe I can mm-hmm. figure out how to get this person to her school.
That's really interesting to me also, because I met you at the makers conference, and this was, you know, a conference about empowering women. When I was looking through one of the issues of the magazine, and it was a particular fashion spread, it was called Guilt Trip, and it was about metallics and clothing threads.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the model. She was really, really, really thin.
Mm.
And it struck me, I wasn't looking for that. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And I looked at that spread, and it was sort of contrast by one of your features called Big Girl in a Skinny World. It's an interesting mm-hmm. Dichotomy. Explain that
to me.
Well,
it's certainly something that I am always on the lookout for in terms of what we're representing to women.
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly looking for I'm always looking to present a diverse group of women in the magazine, mm-hmm. something I'm very aware of and working towards. And this is something, I mean, certainly about body image and what women look like, that the entire fashion industry is working towards.
Do you think it's doing a good enough job?
Probably not. But I don't, you know, I don't speak for the entire fashion
industry.
Of course
not.
And I certainly think that you know, I love our Big Girl in a Skinny World column. It's something I'm really proud of. It was mm-hmm. there before I became editor-in-chief, and mm-hmm. It's something that I continue to promote. I love Nicolette Mason and what she does. We have
She's certainly kind of irreverent and snarky.
Yeah, I love filling the magazine with all sorts of personalities and points of view. And it's something that we constantly talk about with our cover stars and how we photograph them, and it's an ongoing dialogue and conversation.
How do you pick who you want to be on the cover? Is that done by a committee? I mean, recently Jennifer Lawrence.
I would put Jennifer Lawrence on the cover every month. It was totally up to
She's
me.
She's really something, right?
She's really fun. She's really smart, really unguarded, which is great. You know, we have a fantastic entertainment director who lives out in Hollywood, and this is her full-time job. But it's a combination of who has a project that they want to promote. Not every star wants to be on the cover every month, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing negotiation about who's going to be on whose cover at what time. But it's really who has a movie or a song or an album or a project they want to promote, and who has been on our cover most recently.
Sure, you wouldn't want to go there.
Sometimes we would, but they sort of take turns. Like, who's going to, you know, she just did this cover, so she can't do our cover. But it's really a full-time job. And there are people that I've been wanting to have on our cover for years who we're still going after.
And that's just the hugest thing, because that's what sells the magazine. It's who catches your eye, and then you'll read what the articles are inside, right? It's that face, it's that body on the cover of a magazine.
That is the idea. It's sort of, it's not a science that anyone has fully figured out yet. The mm-hmm. alchemy of the star, the look on her face, the item of clothing that she's wearing, the moment in her career, the color, the lines on the, you know, what we say on the actual cover. It's the holy grail.
Have you ever put a man on the cover?
Not since I've been editor-in-chief. But mm-hmm. when I was executive editor, we put a couple of times we tried putting a man and a woman on the cover together.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, they didn't usually sell as well as when we put a girl on the cover or a woman on the cover by herself.
What's the future of magazines? I don't want to read the New York Times online. I want to hold it in my hands. I want to hold a magazine in my hands. Am I an anomaly?
No, you're not an anomaly. People do continue to want to read our magazine, which I'm very happy about. And I agree. I love reading magazines, specifically magazines. I'll read my newspaper online, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I pay to do that. But I also love reading the Sunday New York Times on my
spread out there
when I have the time to mm-hmm. luxuriate mm-hmm. on my couch and read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that magazines have always, in America, really been a reflection of our culture, and they're really a nice filter of the culture through your own, because you choose which magazines you want to read, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to read a home magazine or a political magazine, a fashion magazine. You're filtering the culture through that lens. And I think of our magazine as a tribe or a gathering of like-minded or similarly minded people. So I think that every month we try our best to remain relevant to the people who we're speaking to, and that group grows and expands every month. And really what's changing is the delivery mechanisms through which we speak to that crowd. So we'll always have the magazine, and the print magazine continues to be our main delivery mechanism, but we are evolving how we talk to our audience in terms of how they see us. I mean, through the tools through which they read us. So we've got our digital edition on the tablet. We mm-hmm. have our mobile. We have our Twitter feed. We have our website. We have our three different television shows with which we're affiliated.
What else besides Project Runway?
We have Project Runway, Project Runway All-Stars, and Tim Gunn has a show called Under the Gun,
mm-hmm.
all
right,
of which
right.
we're affiliated with and have various...
You make my head spin.
Well, you know, it's really... We think of the magazine still as the biggest business center of the brand, as mm-hmm. we're now really affiliated, calling ourselves. But so the Mary Claire is what we really are. We're Mary Claire, and we're mm-hmm. a print magazine first, but we're also all of these other offshoots of that brand. And all of our readers and all of our Twitter followers mm-hmm. and all of our Facebook followers and all of our we should probably start doing podcasts, will find us wherever we are, and increasingly they're finding us all over the place, all over the world. We just launched another magazine called Branché, which is an extension of Mary Claire, yet another one.
Spell that.
Branché, B-R-A-N-C-H-E with an accent. It means, loosely, it means plugged in. It means tuned into the culture.
Oh, all right.
And actually, that was a purely print product that we distributed by street teams. I think it's really a matter of remaining relevant and sort of always bringing something new to our readers and keeping them engaged and delighted and surprised and always delivering something juicy and delicious to them. Because this is really, really about, you know, having fun and keeping them entertained and informed and engaged and inspired.
That's wonderful. Well, I think you're pretty inspiring. And I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you. You're just so easy because the time's up.
Thank you so much.
It's really been my pleasure. Join us for another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.